Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings and welcome to Mount Olympus. I am Hercules Invictus, and today I am proud to bring you the Diana Monfort Show with our guest, Diana Monfort, with our host. I'm sorry, Diana Monfort. Greetings, Diana. How are you?
Just fine. How are you?
I'm doing okay. It's been a phenomenally busy day, and it continues to be busy, but other than that, I'm doing great.
What have you been busy with?
What I've been busy with, I'm creating an organization, and I'm trying to recruit folks who can dream it with me and help me actualize it. And I'll talk to you about it another time, gladly.
Okay. Well, anyway, is my guest here?
Your guest is here, yes.
Well, hi, I'm Diana Monfort. I am, believe it or not, the world's first television transgender journalist. And I started my show many years ago, circa 1990. We started shooting in 1990. We started showing in January of 1991 on Manhattan Neighborhood Network. We are now seen, as are all television shows, all over the world. It is live streamed everywhere. And now the wonderful Hercules Invictus has generously given me a podcast to call my own. Well, usually we tackle transgender subjects because I am transgender, and there's precious little attention given to the transgender community unless, excuse me, it is quite negative attention. Ron DeSantis, arch-fascist, being a case in point. We, of course, bring the other side into it, the side of self-determination, bodily autonomy, and freedom of choice, which used to be the American way. I wonder what happened. My. Anyway, my guest is a well-known, history-making transgender activist, Ms. Catherine Platine. Hi, Kathy. How are you?
I'm fine, Diana. How are you?
Just fine. And what are we going to discuss tonight?
Well, we're going to talk about the fact that trans people have been around since the beginning of time. And that we have been a spiritual people and throughout most of that time.
And well, we were certainly the shamans and healers of ancient and often matrilineal societies.
Yes, we absolutely were. And in fact, one of the oldest recipes for sacred food has to be prepared by a trans priestess. And it is an interesting food because it's made up out of cheeses and spices and things that you would find from the very dawning of animal husbandry and when there was still a lot of hunting and gathering going on as well. So, it's an extremely ancient food. The recipe traces back as far as the Sumerians that we know, because, it's a little hard to go much further back than that with absolute certainty. But the food basically was prepared all the way up through at least Roman times, where it was called Moriatum.
Did it do something special for people?
Well, one of the ingredients was rue, which is a extremely strong phytoestrogen, and also was used as an agent to cause abortions.
Good. Well, there you are. And, of course, as we know, the Christo-fascists of the world, Ron DeSantis, Donald Trump, who's about as Christian as a devil, but anyway, they have tied abortion rights to trans rights, often both kinds of self-determination are lumped together as terrible things that must be put a stop to?
Well, interestingly enough, the trans priestesses of the ancient world probably were experts in preparing various potions, including there was a plant that grew in North Africa that was used to the point of extinction, actually, that was an extremely effective for abortions, for example. So that type of herbal knowledge was something that we were well known for in the ancient world.
Well, and we were the healers all across the board. And a family felt honored if one of their children turned out to be androgynous and two-spirited and what we would consider trans.
Well, yeah, actually the priestesses, the trans priestesses were the ones that were brought those children that were intersexed or unusual, you know, because otherwise they were taken out and exposed. And exposed means that they were put on like a mountainside to die. And it was the trans priestesses that gathered these people in. So it was one of our functions back then. And then our close association with being of a spiritual nature goes back to also being part of being the religious leaders and shaman. Shamanistic experiences, for example, frequently included a change of gender as part of the process. So,
well, how did that work?
You would undergo what was called a shamanistic journey. It was a transformation, which, you know, would frequently involve heavy-duty psychotropic drugs. And as part of that descent, and you would be, the description was you would be taken apart and reassembled.
Sort of like being a Marine today, okay.
Yeah, but you know, basically it was a complete change of everything, and you, like I said, it frequently also included a change of gender. So that's it's an interesting to try and figure out whether the change in gender was part of the shamanistic journey, or that it was something that, if you were undergoing a change of gender, then that was part of the shamanistic journey instead. You know, which one was the other is almost impossible to tell.
Ever since the dawn of the Judeo-Christian ethic, and we have been in the moral and social doghouse, and that is not good. And these people often want us dead, or so underground we might as well be dead. And you and I are both old enough to remember when trans folk did indeed live in a kind of social underground until the Stonewall Rebellion, and before that, I believe it was the Compton Rebellion in California. And people just said, no, we're not going to take it. Nope, forget it. Don't try it, fellas. Just don't. And that started the ball rolling, and of course it was trans women who did that. But the rich, gay, white male contingent co-opted the movement and, of course, made it about themselves. You are, I believe, a pagan.
Yes, I am. I'm actually a trans priestess of the goddess.
What goddess?
The goddess Cybele. Which is one of the best-known versions of the Great Mother Goddess.
Hercules, do you hear interference on the line?
Yeah, there might be.
Yes, it's on one of the lines. It's not in the board.
Okay. Shall we hang up and call you right back?
You can both do that if you choose, or if you want, we can test to see whose line it's on.
Okay, let's test it and see whose line it's on.
Okay, I'm going to mute to Catherine for a second. Okay, Diana, say hi or anything you'd like for like half a minute.
Okay, hi. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10.
There you go. You have no interference on your line. Hold on a second.
Okay.
Catherine,
is there interference?
Go ahead.
Can you hear me?
I can hear you very clearly.
Okay. I can hear a little bit of static in the background, but, you know, that seems to be kind of normal for this type of thing.
Okay, so hopefully the static went away. I'll try lowering the sound or making the sound a little louder and see what happens.
All right.
Okay.
So anyway.
I'll be doing that.
All right.
Now, you were saying you are a high priestess of the
I am a priestess of the great of the goddess Sibel, which the Magna Mater, which means Supreme Mother, which is interesting because if you translate the names of the mother goddesses in almost all the traditions, when it's they translate to Mother of the Gods, or you know the Great Mother, it always translates to the same thing regardless of the name, Ishtar, Inanna, you name it, Asura. They all wound up being translated as mother, Great Mother. So it's all the same goddess. Okay.
Including the Virgin Mary in Catholicism.
Well, that was what, Catholicism retained the mother goddess in that form, literally the mother of God, Maria, which translates from the Latin into mother of God. So that's...
Well, what do you do in your religion that sets you apart from the Judeo-Christian tradition?
Well, we believe that the goddess is eminent in all things. And that, therefore, you don't need an intermediary in order to participate in the goddess experience. You are part of the goddess experience, mm-hmm. as it is. All the things around you, and basically, that's what we worship, and that's
the Judeo-Christian world has a problem with it because they like their churches and temples, so people will contribute, and if you don't need an intermediary, you don't need to go to church, and they ain't no contributions, folks.
Well, that's because early Christianity bore very little resemblance to what we call Christianity today. What's called Christianity today might as well be called Paulianity, because it was pretty much an invention of Paul, who never actually knew Jesus, even if that is actual history. Even by
and he was quite the rake in his youth, and then in middle age decided that, oh, no, sex is a bad thing. We have to stop this.
Well, yeah. That was all added on, basically. The early Gnostic churches of Christianity believed in a lot of the same things that most of the so-called heathens and pagans believe in, the reincarnation, the spirit going on and on and on in various forms. Excuse me. The Genesis story, for example, is quite interesting if you want to break it down. I wanted to talk more about trans, but so I'll point out.
Oh, go ahead, please do.
That, for example, we weren't necessarily hated by the early Jews, the Judeo traditions, anyway, because in Isaiah, the prophet Isaiah, 56 verses 1-7, talks about, so let not the eunuch declare himself to be a dry branch. For lo, I shall give you a name that shall not be cut off, and a better place in heaven. That's not an exact quote. I don't have it in front of me here, but that's pretty darn close. In other words, that trans people were, in fact, the chosen people.
There you are.
According to Isaiah and according to Jesus, there is nothing attributed to him that is anti-gay, lesbian. And there is one thing in there about trans people, and that is that, you know, for there are eunuchs that are born eunuchs, there are eunuchs that become eunuchs, and there are eunuchs who become so for the kingdom. Let them who can receive it, receive it. And that is actually the preamble to the part that is usually used in wedding ceremonies. Yeah.
Wonderful.
But, you know, what God has put together, let no man break asunder. But basically what that says, if you understand what eunuch meant, and that it was not the Byzantine eunuch that we think of, you know, in the harem guard type eunuch, but eunuch actually meant somebody who had, according to Deuteronomy, had crushed their testicles between two stones, which was an early form of transgender surgery.
Sort of so, crushing your rocks between rocks, okay.
Yeah, basically getting your rocks off, yes. Which made you an abomination, but, you know, that you were in good company if you were an abomination.
Everyone is an abomination, apparently, yeah. And,
yeah, we were all.
Now, you said you wanted to talk more about trans. How so?
The trans, that you know, that is my belief, the trans... trans people walk between the worlds, literally. They don't just walk between the genders, but they actually walk between the spiritual and the mundane world as part of their existence. And that has been my experience throughout most of my lifetime, is that spirits don't often be able to tell the difference between us and them.
Well, you have several ghosts living in your house.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I grew up in the haunted houses, and I live in a haunted house. And, in fact, there's a spirit of somebody that I know that has just been released that I kind of feel hovering around right now.
Wonderful.
He did a radio show here, and he died unexpectedly about 2 weeks ago. And they're actually holding a memorial for him across the street from here tonight. So, but
well, thanks
kind of
for being with us. That's great.
Yeah,
thank you so much.
Here. Yeah. So, that's kind of...
You know,
of,
speaking
you know,
of that, I do this television show, as you know, and people have written in and asked, well, is she a ghost, meaning me? Is she a space alien, meaning me? Not that I know of, but I once took an acting class at a mall in New Jersey, and it was late at night when we all got out, and I had to walk alone to an exit. Well, there were two policemen up ahead in their police car. They were standing outside, and I happened to be wearing a very 1930s-style dress and 1930s-style hairstyle, and as they saw me in the distance, now I'm very pale, so the lights were reflecting off my skin. I thought they were going to jump out of their skins. They gaped. I know they thought I was a ghost. But as I got closer, they realized that I wasn't. But I thought that was interesting, you know.
I don't think I've ever had a living person think that I was a ghost. But I don't know. Maybe they have. It's possible. But, you know, like I said, I've had plenty of ghosts think that I was one of them. I grew up with ghosts, an old New England family.
Well, you're related to the Adamses, aren't you?
To the Adamses, yes. You know, not Morticia and Gomez, but John Adams and Abigail Adams, the second president of the United States. But I'm also descended from Salem witches on both sides of my family, and probably the ones that had the closest association with actual witchcraft My one ancestor on my mother's side of the family was Susanna Martin, and she was called the Witch of Amesbury, and she'd actually been tried for witchcraft twice before Salem and found guilty and fined for it. They didn't decide to execute her until Salem, and she was quite old by then.
And she must have been very clever to beat the rap twice before that.
She was also very influential, and quite frankly, she scared the hell out of the local townspeople.
In other words, hang me and your crops fail.
Yeah, basically, she supposedly cursed one guy's oxen because he wouldn't bring back rushes from Plum Island, which is where we had a family cottage, actually. And she cursed his oxen, and all of them, except for one, swam straight out to sea and drowned. And the other one went back into the salt marshes and crashed around and got lost forever.
Great. Oh, amazing.
Mm-hmm. And then also she was supposed to get a dog and from another farmer, and the farmer reneged on the deal, and so she cursed him with demon puppies that came and harassed him for about a year. These were the things she was accused of. And then one of the other things that it came up in her trial, because there is a transcript of her trial, is mm-hmm. that she supposedly walked from Amesbury, Massachusetts to Newburyport, which is about 12 miles, in a nor'easter without getting wet.
And that was the deciding factor. They would dunk a witch, and if she drowned, she wasn't a witch. But if she didn't drown, she was a witch. But you sort of lose no matter what happens, you know?
She said, "I scorn to have my feathers bedraveled." was the expression that she used when they asked her how she walked that far without getting wet. So she was quite the character, and apparently also she was accused of coming to men in their dreams at night and having sex with them, but that was very common.
And women would have physical affairs and then say, "Oh, it was a succubus. That's why I'm pregnant." Really?
Yeah, well,
it
worked the other way, too. These guys would...
Oh, yeah, Lilith would come and...
And then say that her spirit had come in the middle of the night and, seduce them, which she was accused of that, too. So apparently she was fairly good-looking when she was younger. And then the
do
other
you,
one...
Do you believe in reincarnation?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I lived
in
India for a couple of years. I saw examples of it. And I actually had experiences with it myself.
Can you tell us something about it?
Well, let's see. I prayed around when I was younger with a Ouija board. And my mother and I were doing it at our Plum Island.
So were my mother and I, yeah.
We're doing it at our Plum Island cottage where Susanna Martin probably had cursed the oxen in the same spot. And we kept getting the same spirit. And it was very curious, and other people would observe us talking to the spirit on the spirit board and basically mock us, including my brother. And the spirit told us her name. It was Susanna Martin. She said she was one of our ancestors, and she gave us a lot of details, and everybody was joking about it, and apparently she had died by drowning. And my brother went down to the town hall, and they were along with one of my cousins looking for records, and they could not find any records. So they went to lunch. When they came back, there was an old book open on the table in the reference room, and it was a picture of the schooner, Susanna Martin. it was a ship named
after. I love things like that. I absolutely love things like that.
And then, well, now the story gets even more interesting because we wanted to know where she lived, and she told us that she lived on Ring Island, which was just north of Newburyport. And she gave us the address and said that there was a portrait of her over the fireplace at that address still. That night, that house burned to the ground.
Oh, my God. That is amazing. That is really amazing. But
yes.
What does this have to do with reincarnation?
Well, because I was in touch every time. I couldn't even walk in a room where people were using a Ouija board without the spirit taking over. And finally, she said to me that she loved me so much she was going to come back as my daughter.
And did she?
And she did. And she did.
And does your daughter have...
My daughter...
Witch-like tendencies, for want of a better term?
Well, she's a very spiritual person, but the Baptist got a hold of her. But she was terrified of water when she was young.
Uh-huh.
Because she had drowned in her previous life. Mm-hmm. Unlike me, which when I was born, apparently I went to water like a duck.
I did too.
They said
I did too.
My mother told me that there was a puddle or of any body of water anywhere within my reach. Even when I was a toddler, I went straight for it.
We used to live in a building with a pool in it, and my parents used to have to watch me because when they weren't watching, I would gleefully jump into the deep end.
Mm-hmm.
And my mother would scream, my father would jump into the water and get me out. But children know how to swim innately, some of them, you know.
Yes, but my daughter, we couldn't even put her in a bassinet. she'd scream.
Well, sure. I mean, she drowned, you know.
Yeah.
And today, people today don't understand that when you read about people in the 18th or 19th centuries bathing, they mean they did it with a sponge or a rag and did what we would call a sponge bath. They did not, as a rule, immerse themselves completely because before indoor plumbing, that wasn't easy.
Well, you did it if you lived on the sea coast.
Sure, and yeah.
Sea
if you lived near a lake or the sea, yeah. But if you didn't, my own great-grandfather, who died in 1906 in Madrid, he used to bathe in what I call a Degas tub, a low round, my grandmother, his daughter, told me, a low round tub with a spout. And in Spain, it's easy to have a maid because they have no factories for people to work in at that time.
Right.
And so the maid would fill it with hot water, it's a low, little shallow tub, and he would bathe in that, you know?
Yeah, and that was normal. And up until we had running water, it was not uncommon for people to not have a bath more than once a week.
Until World War II, actually. That taught the GIs to shower every day. Before that, people bathed once a week or at most twice a week and washed them, and they would wash their hair once every 2 weeks or once a month or never. And, and that was fine. And then World War II, of course, imposed what we would now consider modern hygiene on people who had never heard of it. And that, changed everything. And
well,
the soap manufacturers continued it along by saying, well, you must bathe or shower every single day with our wonderful soap and use our wonderful deodorant.
Well, yeah, because otherwise you stunk. But that's why we had perfumes, basically, was to cover up a human stink. that was the whole purpose behind them.
Excuse me.
At any rate, so yes, I do believe in reincarnation, and it wasn't just my own experiences with my daughter's spirit contacting me, but I also had talked to people basically that had many, many experiences in their family.
I had a past life regression when I was 15, and I've had Akashic Record readings, and I always thought that trans people have been their gender of choice very often, perhaps more often than their birth gender. And that, to a degree, is why we are trans. Because
actually, that's what, yes, my experience as well is that, you know, being born with male attributes, this was the first light that happened to me. And it
was
didn't
not
work.
The first time it's happened to me, but let's hope it's the last. So, you know, I mean, whatever. But,
You know, it's funny. You and I, you know, same experiences. My past lives were all female, and I was usually a teacher or a priestess, or a healer, one of those things. So, in almost all my past lives, and no, I wasn't Cleopatra or whatever. You know.
I know everyone. Listen, there are more Cleopatras around than ants. So,
oh,
I mean,
really?
You know, please, everyone is Cleopatra apparently. But I was not, and neither were you, so there you go. Yeah,
but
actually,
no,
most of us have been Chinese peasants over and over again, you know, because there are more Chinese peasants than anything else on Earth of human beings.
Interestingly enough, from many of the stories that I've heard, the place that you died is more likely to be where you're reborn. And it doesn't matter where you're from because, you know, following the Second World War, there were a lot of British souls reborn into Indian bodies.
Well, that could be their karma since they were quite unnice to the Indians, you know.
It might have been, but it might have also had to do with, you know, where the spirits passed over and they just kind of stuck around in one area.
Well, I sometimes think that a lot of, now this is not going to sound PC, but someone like Sandra Bland or, some person of color who was murdered by the white police might have been a white supremacist in a previous life and is learning that it's not nice to kill people because they're of a different race.
Well, now that's a karmic belief, okay, and that's very Hindu to believe that, you know. And I'm not sure I go completely along those lines. I think because, you know, I have absolutely no proof of anything that I am about to say any more than anybody else does. But it is my belief that when we pass, we are not judged. We judge ourselves.
Oh, yeah, the life review and all that, sure.
Yeah, we do a life review and decide whether we need to learn more certain lessons or not. And that, that it's not a punishment so much as it is a form of trying to have the proper experiences.
You know, there was that boy who went to North Korea and was caught stealing, I believe, a poster or a photograph and from a hotel room and was sentenced. He was an American boy. I think his name was Otto Beer or something like that. He was sentenced to 15 years of hard labor. He died a year later. But I always thought, wouldn't it be funny if he'd been in a previous life or previous lives a judge who sentenced people to hard labor, and now he's found out that that's not a good thing to do.
Well, like I said, you know, I think we pass judgment on ourselves. But, you know, I believe that we are the goddess experiencing herself, that is why we're here.
Do you think we're coming out of a patriarchal phase and will soon return to the natural order, which is matriarchal?
I believe that eventually we will, if the human race survives, because, you know, the only way the human race is going to survive is to get rid of the patriarchal thinking and point of view, which is killing the planet.
And killing
out
one another.
Yeah, but, you know, basically, you know, There was a saying among the, I believe it was the Cheyenne, that the clan mothers ran everything, and that probably is why things worked. And I know it was true of the Iroquois as well. The older females basically ran the tribe. It wasn't like in the stupid movies that you see, with the male chiefs calling all the shots. It was frequently the women that were calling the shots in a lot of Native American traditions, including the Pueblos, for example. So that was true of the Iroquois in the Northeast all the way down to the Southwest. So I'm not sure what the deal was in Mesoamerica, because we don't really have a good handle on what Mesoamerican societies actually were like and how they were organized, mainly because the Spanish destroyed all of their records, for the most part, all the
which they considered instruments of the devil. And being half Spanish, I can speak on this. Spain, even today, it's obsessed with religiosity, with death. It's a very morbid country. We made black clothes chic. We're the ones who invented black as chic, basic black. We did it. We are very, very straight-laced and prim, and far from the popular image of Spaniards as wild and crazy sex machines. We are frigid and rigid and doctrinaire and not open free thinking.
You're blowing my images of, the Zorro movies and everything.
Yes, well, that was Mexico, by the way. But yeah, Mexicans are. I think in the colonies they were a lot more fun. And you should know that when the people who colonized South and Central America were usually people from Andalusia, which is in the south of Spain, and they are a fun bunch. It's the middle, which is Castile, and north of Spain, where my family's from, the middle and north, where we are straight-laced and rigid and frigid and all sorts of idjids, you know.
Okay, but you know what? In the middle of the one of the biggest squares in Madrid is a statue of Sibel being pulled in a chariot.
La Cibeles, yes. It is right near the Ritz Hotel. And it is the most famous fountain in Madrid. And people use it in many ways. Like, I'll meet you at Las Cibeles at 2 and we'll do lunch. Something like that, you know. Yes, it is very famous. And it is much loved.
And it is, a statue to Sibel, Magna Mater.
Yeah.
So, and in the dramatic traditions, we had Freya. And her chariot was pulled by cats. and, of course...
Which gives new meaning to the term pussy power, yes.
Well, exactly. But, you know, Sibel was associated with lions all the way back to Chetzalhotep, which was somewhere around 8,000, 9,000 BCE. And so, you know, that connection basically carried on through. One of the ways I knew that the mother goddess traditions were all basically the same religion, you know, that had about as much differences between a Presbyterian and a Baptist, okay, is that the mother goddess associations have remained the same. They associated with bulls. My theory on that is that trans women invented that. That was a remembrance. Because if you understand, during hunting-gathering tribes, the males were expected to bring in food, although we're discovering it that was not quite as rigidly sex-rolled as we thought.
Whoever was good at hunting did the hunting, exactly. Yeah.
Basically, but domesticating cattle meant that there was now, you know, you had milk production, which was wonderful. But if you know anything about raising cattle and dairy, you know that you only need one bull for about 20 or so cows in order to freshen the cows, which is to get them pregnant, basically. And so all the other, but, the laws of genetics, you're going to wind up with about half of the offsprings are going to be male. And so they're not needed. But what are they? They're a gift of protein. They are a gift of meat.
Yes.
From the goddess. So that would be venerated as a gift of the goddess. And, of course, we also had the goddess associated with snakes, birds of prey, and bees. And those associations held all the way through to the classical period, all those associations. And if you think about the story of Genesis, basically, who lied?
I don't understand what you mean.
Okay. Yahweh said to Eve, don't eat from this tree of knowledge, and don't eat from this tree of life. Okay? And because if you do, you will surely die. And the serpent came along and said, that's bullshit. You know? Go ahead, eat freely. And if you look at that story in an entirely different, light, you know, rather than thinking of the serpent as being the devil tempting Eve, if you realize that what the serpent was saying was that you have the right of knowledge and you live forever in the form of, you know, your soul going on, the tree of knowledge and the tree of life. And Eve ate and bam, Yahweh got all mad. Because she didn't die. If you look at it from that light, the story changes quite a bit, doesn't it?
Yes, and snakes were venerated as symbols of God until Christianity took hold, and now snakes are symbols of the devil. And in the Catholic religion, not too long ago, they used to tell us, don't read the Bible. We'll tell you what to think. I mean, you know, talk about arrogance. That's crazy. But that was typical of the Catholic Church.
No, that was typical of the Catholic Church up until the Reformation, which basically wasn't possible until the Gutenberg Bible came along. And the Bible was available for people
to
read.
Well, actually, this goes, I remember in the early 1960s being a school child, learning every morning in Catholic school for an hour. First subject we did was an hour of catechism. And that was usual, circa 1963-64, mm-hmm. that, we were told, well, we'll tell you what to think, you know.
Well, yeah, but that's always been true. That's how you maintain power.
Yeah, that's my point. That it's all BS. It's all a house of cards. It's a very pernicious institution, what with the Inquisition and colonization and all sorts of things, and that people would think that their take on trans people, that we are somehow an abomination, when it is they who are the abominations. All right, here's something you might like to know.
Okay.
My grandfather was a Catholic priest during his late teens and early 20s. When he was 27, he wrote a pamphlet, a 12-page pamphlet, called The Rural Priest. It debunked the Catholic Church. This is in 1904 in Spain. It told how the Church abused people, how they took what little money they had, how they used their daughters and sons as sex slaves, all sorts of things. Made him a star throughout the Spanish-speaking world, a political star. He quit the priesthood. By mutual accord, the church said, fine, go, bye-bye, see ya, don't come back. And, I don't know where this was leading, but my point is that there were always people who understood that the church was a very pernicious organization. And even in hyper-Catholic Spain at the turn of the 20th century, anyone who thought, who had a brain cell to his or her name, knew that something was really wrong with this institution, you know?
Yeah. One of my sister priestesses and my best friend, she was excommunicated twice from the Catholic Church. The first time they did it up brown with the, you know, putting out the candles and, you know, the whole thing, the whole ceremony, you know. And the second time was like, you're excommunicated, you know, because they seemed to have forgotten that they'd already done it once before. But she helped us discover, for example, that there was a group of Benedictine nuns that was practicing the Sibylline rituals up until, well, just recently.
Did they know they were Sibylline rituals? Or were they couched as Catholic nun rituals?
They were kind of couched a little bit, but they kind of knew what was going on, okay? Because they didn't do them anywhere near public. And the Mother Superior basically helped us basically reclaim the rule of the women of Sibel, which we reclaimed from the rule of the women of St. Benedict, which is much, much older than the rule of the men of St. Benedict. And it goes back to what was called the Montanist heresy. And the Montanist heresy was Montanists believed that women were equal to men in the eyes of the church, which was heresy, and that was also a Cathar heresy, which became associated with the Knights Templar and
who were also executed by the Catholic Church, and
Their core belief was that if you were waiting for the second coming and you were ignoring women, then you were likely to miss it. Because the second coming.
Well, to this day in the Catholic Church, women are not allowed to be priests.
Right. Except in the American Catholic Church.
No, they cannot be priests.
Yes, in the American Catholic Church, yes, which is different from the Holy Catholic Church. It's a different. It's
no,
a different
they, well, there must be a branch I don't know about because trust me.
It is a
me.
Branch because the former First Lady of Ohio, Dagmar Celeste, was one of the very first women priests in the American Catholic tradition.
That's amazing. I did not know that.
I met
because
her and her
church,
husband.
The church, as ruled by the Vatican, says, nah, no woman can defile the host by putting her hands on it.
Well, that's true, but, you know, we... how much time? We haven't got a lot of time left, but I could tell you stories about the Catholic Church and the Sibylline.
I could tell you... Okay, when my grandfather wanted to marry my grandmother, he left the priesthood, he became a lawyer. Because they lived in Spain... a man who, even though he quit the priesthood, was not allowed to defile himself by being intimate with a woman. Well, my grandfather, being a smart cookie, decided that France, being under the Napoleonic Code, did allow priests, former priests, to marry. So they got married there. It was a legal marriage, and Spain had to accept it. And no doubt with gritted teeth and a furious scowl, but they had to accept it. So, I mean... there have always been ways around the tyranny of the Catholic Church, one way or another.
Well, interestingly enough, the Vatican, Mons Vaticus in Latin, means Hill of the Seers. Well, guess who the Seers were?
Trans
the
people.
The Sibylline priestesses, which included a lot of trans women. And, you know, that's a very interesting history. But the Catholic Church inadvertently rebuilt our Frisianum. Pope Pius IV did it when they came back to Rome, and they discovered that there was a, it was just a mess because of all the changes that had been done there, and it was, mosquito ridden and everything else. And there was one place that was not all that bad, and it was they rebuilt all the ancient structures there, which would have been the housing complex of the Sibylline priestesses of the Roman period. And it's called Casino Pio Quattro. It exists to this day. The courtyard is still there, and the Catholic Church erected an intact statue of Cybele in the corner of it where she belonged.
That's amazing. And that is amazing.
And they are freaked out by it, but it is the only place on the Vatican grounds where female dignitaries can be met because they know exactly what it was and what they did.
Now, this is too interesting. Now, we're almost out of time, but you are too interesting to just let go of. So will you come back next month?
I will. I'll be glad to.
Let me explain now. This podcast, the Diana Montfort Show, is on the third Saturday of every month from 9 to 10 Eastern Standard Time. And Kathy was the guest on the last one we did. She is a font of information. So it's impossible to contain her knowledge into a one-hour format. So I'm so glad you've agreed to come back next month and further discuss this and anything else you want to discuss.
Oh, well, there's a ton of things we can talk about. Okay. We want to, go after the Catholic
You may
Church,
wind up being
it.
The co-host, you know that, don't you? Because you're so smart. You're fun.
Well, anyway, it's kind of enjoyable. I don't know how much time we've got left tonight, but look, we have a few minutes left. But, yes,
You have eight minutes, actually.
How long?
Pardon?
8 minutes.
Okay.
8 minutes. Oh, we got a little bit of time then. Okay, fine. We were originally one of the only official religions of Rome, and that came about during the Punic Wars, which was the wars with Hannibal and Carthage, okay? Mm-hmm. And during that time, Rome was getting its butt kicked, and they went to the Oracle of Cumaea, and also the one at Delphi, the Sibyls, they were called. They were the holy women who basically, did the telling of the ancient world. And both of them basically said the same thing, that they had to bring the Great Mother from Anatolia, and Pernosis, the city of Pernosis in particular, to Rome. And if they did so, and they venerated her, then as long as they venerated her, Rome would prosper. So they did send an emissary to Pernosis, and they brought back the symbol of Cybele, which was a volcanic rock, and a statue. And when it landed at Ostra, the seaport that they in Rome, in Italy, that leads to Rome, up the Tigris, the boat got stuck, and Claudia Quintus, who was considered a woman of ill repute, was among the matrons of Rome that had come down to welcome Cybele, and she said, shoot everybody away, and she grabbed a hold of the rope, and this is according to legend, and single-handedly pulled the barge off the sandbar, and then she was like, she was like all that in a box of chips after that.
Right,
And the House of Claudia became an extremely powerful in the church. So, and then what happened during the war was that Scipio, who was one of the generals, was also among the group that welcomed her to Rome. And he went on to kick Hannibal's ass, and defeat the Carthage. And from that time, we basically got to call a lot of the shots. And we were the official religion of Rome for 500 years.
That is great.
Yeah. And that we were, you know, that the Roman Senate feared us quite a bit, and there was a lot of stories about, you know, how they tried to basically put limits on the powers. But when they brought the priestesses that came from Anatolia, which is Turkey now, they were all basically lived in the wild areas. And so they didn't really want to live in Rome proper. They built the palace or the temple to on the Palatine Hill, which is one of the seven hills of Rome. But across the river, there was this wild, you know, hill that, you know, nobody had basically
running out of time. Yeah.
Anyway, and that was the Mons Vaticus. That was the Hill of the Seers. That was
now,
the
if
Vatican.
If people want to contact you, how do they do it?
You can get a hold of me on Facebook, Kathy Platine, Catherine Platine. I have
with a C.
With C A T H R Y N, P L A T I N E. I'm pretty easy to find on Facebook. You can also look for the Matrium of Sibel. And get a hold of me that way, which is Maetreum of Sibel. And my email address is Catherine or Kathy at galae.com, galae.com. So you can get a hold of me that way. So, you know, I'm not that hard to reach.
And
I will write.
Folks, yeah. I just want to say that if you want a truly interesting correspondence, Kathy's your gal. She is brilliant and knows a lot about a lot of things. So, you know, if you're looking for seriously intelligent correspondence, Kathy's the one. Anyway, my guest has been actually world-renowned transgender activist Kathy or Catherine Platine. She is a trans woman. She is one of the great immortal transgender activists of our world, and she will be remembered for who knows how long, a very long time, I would imagine. And anyway, I'm Diana Montford. This has been the Diana Montford Show, and here's my tagline. Hey, even if no one else loves you, I love you, and I do. And, you know, Kathy didn't get paid for this. I don't get paid for this. It costs Hercules money to put this stuff on. We do it out of love because we love you and we want you to know stuff and to grow and to be all that you can be. Anyway, I love you a lot, and I will see you 3 weeks from now with Ms. Kathy Platine, and we will continue this discussion and discuss many other things. Love you a lot. See you next time. Bye.
Thank you, Diana. Thank you, Kathy. And Kathy, I'll be contacting you. I'm gathering voices of Greco-Roman Egyptian spirituality, and I'd love to add your voices to the conversation.
Oh, I'd be honored.
And thanks to our wonderful listeners. And whether you called in, whether you clicked on a link and found yourself here, whether you'll be checking us out later on demand, until next time, this is us wishing you joyous journeys and amazing adventures. And thank you again, Diana, and thank you again, Kathy.